coming up on New York Now.
Approximately 64,000 are estimated to lose coverage in your district under this bill. How exactly did you give a voice to all of us constituents?
Well, thank you.
North Country Congresswoman Elise Stefanik responds to questions from her constituents at a community forum. Also, Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio and Ken Lovett of the Daily News join the Reporters Roundtable.
This is going to be a huge issue. What are you doing to reunify the Senate for the Democrats? That's going to hang over his head, as it would if he runs for president.
New York Now is next, right here on PBS.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET. Winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program, this is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan.
And I'm Casey Seiler from the Times Union. Well, the Senate's Independent Democratic Conference faces a lulu of a controversy.
We can talk about that at the Reporters Roundtable. First up, it was a busy week, both in state and national news. We start our look at headlines with a community forum in Plattsburgh with Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, Elise Stefanik, Scott DeNoe. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Elise Stefanik, Scott DeNoe.
The upstate representative has been under fire from some in the North Country for her yes vote on the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, better known as Obamacare. For the first time since getting reelected in 2016, she held a public forum at our sister station, Mountain Lake PBS, where she was peppered with several questions on health care.
You just voted to decimate millions of dollars of Medicaid. And I'm wondering, this is just a brief question, what is the fraud and abuse that you're talking about? I work with low-income families and many working poor families every day for the past 35 years. Those people are not abusing Medicaid. They are working, and many of them have been able to, through our previous administration's very hard-fought battle, gotten good health care coverage. What is the abuse that you're talking about? And why did you decide to reduce the amount of Medicaid? And then I have a question for you, but I want to follow up.
So that first question regarding the Medicaid, what is included in this bill deals with the Medicaid expansion population, and it has a three-year process by which states that have expanded Medicaid can choose to continue doing that, but the state will have to pick up the traditional 50-50% rather than the 90-10% federal match. So it really has to do with the Medicaid expansion population so that we can reallocate the funds towards traditional Medicaid.
When it comes to Medicaid, I heard you say that earlier.
Right.
So what about, what are the fraud, what's the fraud what and the abuse?
In New York, there have been studies. We pay more per recipient of Medicaid than California, Texas, and Florida combined. I think some of the administrative costs are especially high in New York, and there have been instances of serious abuse. I think Medicaid dollars should be going to the patients, making sure that it's providing the coverage for the patients you talked about. That should be the priority, the vulnerable population, the population that absolutely needs that safety net, rather than some of the wasteful spending. We have waste in every agency.
Okay, and you also were just talking about the itemized bills, the high cost that hospitals charge. So let me ask a question. You have said in the past that you would never vote for a single-payer healthcare system. The CBO reports, and it sounded like you just said, no, I won't, without any discussion. The CBO reports that you have received over $32,000 from the health insurance industry for your campaign. So I can see why you would reject even the thought of a discussion about the single-payer system. I would like to remind you and your colleagues that there's plenty of evidence to support that a lot of these problems could be solved if we had a single healthcare system.
You can watch the entire forum by heading to mountainlake.org. Also this week, our partners at the Times Union held a forum with the two legislative leaders at their new Hearst Media Center. Speaker Carl Hastie and Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan answered questions about procurement reform, President Trump's tax plan, and charter schools. Moderator Casey Seiler also asked about the relationship between the two.
You're divided by party, you're divided by political ideology in many ways, but not in, you know, I think you probably agree on things more than you disagree on things. But is there a sense that the two of you are the only two who understand what this job is like? I do not, for example, think that this would be a very interesting or pleasant discussion if 3 years ago we had Dean Skelos and Sheldon Silver here. I think that would be kind of like two scorpions in a bottle almost. Speaking of which, is this the 2 year anniversary of your becoming leader? I believe it's this week, isn't it?
Yeah, Thursday.
Thursday? Yep. Oh, okay, you marked it on the calendar?
Thursday.
Somebody get him a cake. Speak to that if you would. I mean, what is that relationship like? What's that kind of understanding of the other's job like?
All right, I'm going to do a little tongue in cheek. I lay awake at night thinking, I got to call Carl. Am I trimming the right way? Am I doing this? You know, we'll talk about education later. No, but this is something that people really have a hard time comprehending. You can go at it as colleagues and periodically as adversaries. But I like this guy. He's a good guy, and he's a gentleman. And he's an incredibly hard worker on behalf of his conference. There are a lot of things that we don't agree on. And there are a lot of things, by extension, that our conferences are not going to agree on. But that doesn't mean that you can't have some professionalism, some diplomacy. And really, you know, I think I'm very grateful that I have the opportunity to serve in the capacity I do. I think the speaker had a bigger challenge than I did, because I came in after the budget. He was quintessential baptism by fire.
In 2015.
Yes, 2015. And I don't, you know, the speaker is quite adept at speaking for himself, but from a colleague standpoint, we joke around, you know, we have 32, and we work very closely with the IDC. The speaker has more than 100 members. I know what it's like just trying to keep in touch with our own members. You know, if he sits down and says, I got to call everybody, that's like knocking out a day just to call people on the phone. So there should be a positive discord, and we're going to disagree on things, but that you can disagree without being disagreeable. And we can, there, at the end of the day, we need to do the people's business. And he will be a staunch advocate for his conference, as I will be for our members, and I think we are respectfully meeting our obligations in that regard.
I come from a district that my own assembly district where I probably have less than 1,000 registered Republicans. And when I first got elected, I thought Republicans were one-eyed monsters. So when I got up here, I was surrounded by nothing but Republicans. And, you know, I say that because it's like you come up here with one mindset and you realize that those same people that I thought were one-eyed monsters were human beings, and they think the same in terms of politically, locally for them. And all politics is really local. And you end up developing relationships with people regardless of party affiliation. And yes, when we do sit around the room sometimes, and when we do have a leaders meeting and we say, all right, well, we have to go back, I do, you know, tongue-in-cheek say to them, well, Governor, you have to talk to yourself, so that's a tough enough job, you trying to convince yourself what to do. And I, you know, and I say to
wandering down the hall of right. governors talking
so,
to himself.
So I said to Senator Klein and Senator Flanagan the same thing. And yes, it is a challenge, but it is also, you know, a luxury. I'm extraordinarily grateful to have 106 colleagues who have given me this ability to do it. But what I do sometimes, I try to do is I do try to understand other people's positions that they're in. Yes, sometimes it's a little easier for us to do because we have more of a margin than maybe John does. And I do sometimes understand his challenge that he doesn't have the same margins. But on the other hand, he doesn't have to make as many phone calls, you know, as I do. Maybe has as long of a conference when you want to hear 106 different opinions, in addition to my own, from all across the state to try to come out to one like mine. But in the end, that people don't care about that. They all elect us individually to come up here and do a job for all of the members individually. And for John and his leadership role in mine, it is our job to hone their messages and come to some agreement with the governor. That's, at the end of the day, that's what we're supposed to do.
At the Capitol this week, a spotlight was put on the medical aid in dying legislation. It was reintroduced this year in the Assembly by Westchester County's Amy Paulin. It would give mentally capable, terminally ill adults with 6 months or fewer to live the option of getting a doctor's prescription for medication they could take if their end-of-life suffering becomes unbearable. Rochester's Susan Ron, who was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer 4 years ago, spoke in support of the bill.
While I am aware of the Catholic Church's position on medical aid in dying, I strongly disagree. My suffering during the dying process will only harm those I love, especially my son. I don't want him to question, why did my mom have to suffer? Why did God do this to her? My God is a compassionate God, and he doesn't call for those to go through needless suffering to prove that they believe in him. I've had friends and people ask me, but isn't this just a kind of suicide? Medical aid in dying is absolutely not suicide, because I want to live. I want to live more than anything else. I want to see my son graduate college. I want to see him finish medical school. I want to someday hold my grandchildren. I'm not suicidal. What I don't want is to suffer and be in controllable pain while my body shuts down from what could be weeks. And I don't want my son and my family to have to watch me go through that.
Silent protesters held signs during the press conference objecting to what some of them call assisted suicide.
What we heard today was an emotional appeal to people's sympathy, right? And we're not unsympathetic. We understand that, of course, you want to relieve pain. The problem with this bill is not that it relieves pain, but that it exposes disabled people and seniors to a deadly form of abuse. Disabled people and seniors already experience abuse at the hands of family members and caregivers at significantly higher rates than the rest of the population. And that's the world that this bill enters into. It gives abusers, it gives people who want to coerce disabled people, people who are tired of taking care, heirs who are interested in seeing mom or dad go away. It gives them a very loose framework to make that happen.
Carl Hasty and John Flanagan said they do not expect there to be enough support for the legislation in their chambers. And finally, Senate Democrats proposed a series of anti-gun violence bills in response to the president's address last week to the National Rifle Association.
State government needs to protect New Yorkers from the reckless behavior and anti-firearm safety views of our president and his allies around the country and here in New York. Just over a week ago, the president spoke at the NRA and bragged about rolling back so many crucial gun control measures. He spoke about weakening existing gun laws. For many of us, this is really terrifying.
The bills are not expected to come to the floor of the Republican and IDC-controlled chamber. For analysis of this week's news, we turn to my partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, who moderates our Reporters Roundtable.
All right, and now for some analysis of the week's news. From near and far, I'm happy to be joined at the Reporters Roundtable by Ken Lovett of the Daily News and Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. All right, trouble for the IDC this week, the Senate Independent Democratic Conference, in the form of two back-to-back stories from Jesse McKinley in the New York Times that noted that three members of that breakaway Democratic faction, Diane Savino, Dave Valesky, and recent addition, Jose Peralta, have been receiving Lulus for committee chairmanships, despite the fact that they are not committee chairmen.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with giving them Lulus. The Senate Republicans are in power. They can give stipends to anybody they want. But the problem here is they said they were committee chairmen, and they sent an email to the state controller's office saying, yes, they're the chairs of those committees, and they were paid for that. And that, you know, apparently is could very well be illegal. So why they did that, you know, it's just like you just wonder why people do things like that.
And
you
even
know?
Giving out the stipend, it's a gray area because the stipends by law go to the committee chairs and to the ranking members of the committee from the minority party. So by giving it to the vice chairs, they gave these IDC members vice chair positions, and no vice chairs have been paid before stipends. It's not in the law. Now, it doesn't expressly prohibit it, so that's kind of the loophole. That's the gray area.
Is there such a thing as a vice chair, though? I can't say I've ever heard of it until this story surfaced.
Well,
yeah,
we have vice and we have chairs, so why can't we have vice chairs?
Well, I know, really.
The IDC claims that the payments are proper because of a clause, as Ken mentioned, that allows for service in any, quote, special capacity therein or directly connected therewith to the committee work.
That's very good, yes. and it is a gray area. And, you know, Albany operates within the loopholes, and they often do. Now the question is, though, if they falsely gave information to the comptroller's office that these people were actual chairs and that's why they're getting the stipends, that's a different question. Then the question is, did they file a false instrument? Could that be a crime? And, you know, the question is, will somebody look into it?
Well, that's the bigger question. Who's going to pursue it? We don't have Preet Bharara anymore. He was fired. I'm not really sure who's running that U.S. Attorney's office.
The Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, has not been shy about going after stuff like that.
Would he, though? I mean, that's something that we haven't heard anything from him. It's true, the story just broke,
It
just broke this week. But he didn't, you know, come right out of the box saying that he was going to look at it. Or would it go to the Albany County DA, David Soares? I'm not sure which jurisdiction.
Well, David Soares hasn't...
He hasn't gone after anything at all.
Well, I know, but that doesn't mean that it might not be his responsibility to do it. So that's the big question. Is somebody going to pursue it? When we had Preet Bharara there, every little thing got pursued.
And the the Northern District also from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Politically, too, this is an issue because the IDC, since the election of Donald Trump and really since Jose Peralta switched a couple months ago, has been under intense fire from the left. I mean, they always have, but it's really grown exponentially heading into next year's election. And this just adds to the criticism of that group.
And consequently, places pressure on Governor Cuomo, who has been seen as basically acceding to the existence of the IDC, and because divided government or a divided legislature aids him in his initiatives.
And if he's facing a primary next year, which people expect he may from the left, whether it's a serious one or not, we don't know yet. But if he faces a primary from the left, this is going to be a huge issue. What are you doing to reunify the Senate for the Democrats? That's going to hang over his head, as it would if he runs for president in 2020.
Campaign issue for the IDC members, too. This can be used against them in saying, oh, you were paid off to cooperate with the Senate Republicans. So
and
it just
already
looks bad
primaries,
for them.
Lining up against the IDC members.
Yeah, they've always been kind of walking a fine line here. So, and especially in the era of Trump, it's a little more difficult for them to rationalize why you would want to work with the Republicans, because everybody's just getting so partisan now.
Also facing difficulties of a very different kind are downstate commuters who are living with a situation that is increasingly becoming, as Governors Cuomo and Christie put it in a release on Thursday night, a situation that has gone from bad to worse to intolerable outside of Penn Station and the rail lines coming in and out of Penn Station.
Well, take your pick. Delays, sewage coming off the out of the walls.
Right.
Lengthy delays, the need to for construction that's going to cause even more delays throughout the summer. It's just a horrible situation, and commuters are rightfully angry.
Yeah, they've just let Penn Station fall apart for so many decades. I can't tell you how long I've been hearing that they were going to redo the post office and Penn Station was going to be nice. And Governor Cuomo did start something, I think it was over a year ago now, but there hasn't been any signs of it progressing. And they've just, you know, let it, you know, deteriorate to such a point where it just seems awful in a really big city, world-class city like New York City, that you would have a station like that.
And Amtrak is getting the blame because is, you know, basically runs it and operates it. The governors, as you said, Cuomo and Christie, are now, they've been taking heat. Where have you been this week? You've been quiet on all this
interesting
stuff.
Governor Cuomo, did he have one public appearance this week? He didn't have any.
And they
usually
put a
if there's
out.
Some kind of train derailment or something, he's right there, you know, on CNN and talking about
it. So I think he was forced into doing something on Thursday night. night, which resulted in the letter, because it's just getting out of hand. Plus, there was a hearing that day over that the assembly held on Amtrak, and it didn't go well for Amtrak.
But Cuomo and Christie definitely try to distance themselves, although you could argue that, you know, the MTA and the Port Authority should be doing something about that. I mean, that's just a major, major train station.
We also this week, in the headlines sequence, we heard from the legislative leaders on what the end of session will bring. I must say, I moderated that discussion.
And who was asking them the questions?
It was a very pleasant discussion. You got a real sense of how these two guys think of each other. But I didn't think we got a real hard sense of what exactly the initiatives are going to be that are going to define the end of the session.
I don't think
session.
They know yet. Yeah. I mean, honestly, the governor came out after the budget and said, I got everything I wanted. You know, I'll take my cue from them. And I'm not sure whether they want to fight him on issues like procurement reform, the new budget got rid of requirements that his controversial Startup New York jobs program, that they had a report every year on job development and creation. And that got rid of that requirement. There's bills that would restore that. But will they go to war with him? Will they pass these bills? And then if he vetoes them, will they override it? My guess is they don't have the stomach right now to do either.
And is it really worth it to them politically? I could see the session just kind of fading away in June without too many more, you know, major things happening, unless, you know, some kind of outside incident, like we saw what was happening with the IDC. Perhaps some other outside incident will prompt them, you know, to act on something.
Typically, what we've seen a lot of times is the stories start getting written that it's a Seinfeld session, a session about nothing, and then the governor will create something, whether it's generated by the news, something Trump does, Amtrak, whatever it is, and then he'll come out and say, here's a policy proposal that we need to get done before the end of session, and that's when the horse
turns. We're running out of time. We're into the second week in May for something like that.
And the only thing that
has
to get done right now, really, is mayoral control of the schools in New York City. Mm-hmm. Is the law that governs it is set to expire. We expect it'll be renewed another year, but that has to get done. Anything else? No.
Yeah, but that's a good point, though. Cuomo hates to be quiet for too long. If it looks like he's not, like, right in the center of the action, that he may bring up something.
But this year he's also got the building stuff that he's focused on, so he doesn't need them as much as he did in the past.
And he's also got the trials coming up of his close associates and the corruption scandal with the economic development, so he may not want to, you know, put attention on this procurement reform that the legislature is pushing the controller's bill to reinstate his authority to oversee these contracts.
He was, as you know, very quiet this week, but as Ken reported, he did in fact make an appearance, but that was in an ad touting the Liberty Defense Project, which is a public-private initiative that he started up to basically provide legal services to immigrants. It raised questions among some that it's part of the sort of glide path to 2020, conceivably.
Right. And is it something that's promoting him for 2020 and, you know, trying to build credibility on the left? Also, the fact that it's a nonprofit created by people close to him, his former chief of staff, Steve Cohn, the former city council, New York City Council Speaker, Christine Quinn, and Ken Sunshine, a PR guru. These people are as close to Cuomo as you can get, a lot of them, and they've created this. They're going to be raising money again, but we're not going to see who's giving because they don't have to disclose.
This sounds very familiar to an organization we remember from a couple of years ago called the Committee to Save New York.
And de Blasio had one, you know, the Committee for One New York, whatever that was called.
It falls into a gray area where they don't have to report
donors
to the Board of Elections. I know, really. There's a lot of nuances in life, right? It's not a lobby firm, so they don't have to report to the lobbying commission. And then it also says that they're going to help, you know, immigrants seeking legal aid if the federal government is harassing them. But I noticed on the ad it doesn't say call this number or how they're going to help.
No, and they're going to raise money for this project too, because it's a public-private partnership. So a lot of money is going to be raised. We just don't know how and from who.
Public-private partnerships. I love them. All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks very much to Ken Lovett. It's been too long. Come back soon. And Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. And now we'll kick it back to Matt at the desk.
All right, thanks, Casey. This week, John Flanagan marked the second anniversary of becoming Senate Majority Leader. Our poll question asks, how would you rate his tenure in this role? Let us know by logging on to our website, nynow.org. Last week, we asked how likely you'd be to utilize ride-sharing, which will be available later this summer across the state. 40% said very likely, but 48% said unlikely. Ron in Albany said he was very likely to utilize the service. Having used Uber in other states with fast and inexpensive service, I'm appalled at how long it takes for cab service at Albany airports. Alexander in Monroe, watching on WNET, voted the same. I have been unable to get to work or back when scheduled buses cancel and taxis were unavailable. Ride sharing could make it possible for me to survive. And finally, John and Troy said, living outside the urban centers, the frequency we'd use it is likely low. We do, however, support its inception. Thank you to all those who voted this week. To do so in our poll, just head to nynow.org. That's where you can stream all of our past programs, plus follow links to us on social media, including Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. You'll also find a link to the Capital Confidential blog, which is also found at timesunion.com.
All right, well, it's been a fairly vicious spring weather-wise in the Capital Region, and it might be that way again this weekend. So for some solace, we're going to leave you with some very nice spring weather. I'm Casey Seiler of the Times Union.
I'm Matt Ryan. We'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.
Funding for New York Now is provided by WNET.